Blog Talk Radio.
Two is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find information about this series at speculist.com and worldtransformed.com. This series explores 10 major transformations that will forever change our world and our lives. Some of these transformations are likely to be upon us soon, others are already underway. Throughout this series, we're talking with futurists, scientists, philosophers, artists, pundits, and other thinkers to gain a better understanding of what we need to do to prepare ourselves for these changes and for life in a world transformed. In the World Transformed 2, we're exploring how we think, life extension, nanotechnology, human enhancement, artificial general intelligence, virtual worlds, post-scarcity, existential risks, the technological singularity, and finally, human destiny. Tonight, we present part 9 in the series, The Future Transformed. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm also doing great. You know, this has been an exciting series. All great guests. Every single one of them are brilliant, and tonight's going to be no exception. I'm very excited about tonight.
Well, this is going to be a terrific show. One of our favorite topics, obviously, to talk about is accelerating change and the technological singularity. And so, why don't we jump right into it?
Sounds great.
All right. Well, you know, ever since the airing of the original World Transformed series 2 years ago, I've started every Fast Forward radio show by talking about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lies at the heart of this, I believe, the greatest period of transformation in human history. And each week I point out that the world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict and sometimes even difficult to imagine. Accelerating technological change may soon alter our world beyond recognition. And the question is that a good thing or not? Well, in 1993, science fiction writer Vernor Vinge presented at a NASA-sponsored conference a paper in which he outlined some fairly startling predictions. And I'm going to read in part from his paper, quote, "Within 30 years, we will have the technological means to create superhuman intelligence. Shortly after, the human era will be ended. From the human point of view, this change will be a throwing away of all the previous rules, perhaps in the blink of an eye, an exponential runaway beyond any hope of control. Developments that before were thought might only happen in, quote, a million years, if ever, will likely happen in the next century. I think it's fair to call this event a singularity. It is a point where our old models must be discarded and a new reality rules. As we move closer to this point, it will loom vaster and vaster over human affairs till the notion becomes a commonplace. Yet, when it finally happens, it may still be a great surprise and a greater unknown," end quote. So tonight we'll be talking about accelerating change and the technological singularity with three very special guests, beginning with a panel discussion between Philip von Netteveld and Anders Sandberg. And in a segment coming up a little bit later this evening, we'll present our interview with Ray Kurzweil. So let's introduce our panel, Stephen.
All right. Philip von Netteveld wears many hats, spanning the nonprofit and techno-entrepreneur for-profit worlds. His portfolio personality includes his role as European director and spokesperson of the nanotech-focused Foresight Institute since 1997, and co-authoring the Foresight Guidelines for Responsible Nanotechnology Development. He is also a board member and international spokesperson at the Lifeboat Foundation, a nonprofit public interest organization dedicated to helping humanity grapple with global catastrophic risk and possible misuse of increasingly powerful technology. As a keynote speaker at conferences, the overarching theme of Philip's nonprofit work is dedicated to and focused on maximizing the upside of these technologies and minimizing their potential downsides, primarily through emphasis on public education and public policy development projects around nano, bio, info, cogno technologies. His goal is to help policymakers, corporate decision makers, and the lay public to make the medium long-term decisions that are as informed as possible about these still too little known trends and probable future scenarios. Philip joins us this evening, not so much as a representative of the organizations just mentioned, but providing his own personal perspectives, drawing from his expertise and scientific background in communication science and the social sciences. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you for having me on your show again.
Well, it's terrific to have you back, Philip. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I'd also like to introduce Anders Sandberg. Anders is a James Martin Research Fellow at the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford University. He is involved in interdisciplinary research on cognitive enhancement, neurotechnology, global catastrophic risks, emerging technologies, and applied rationality. He has been writing and debating about transhumanism, future studies, neuroethics, and related questions for some time now. Anders is also an associate of the Oxford Center for Neuroethics and is a co-founder of the Swedish think tank Eudoxa. Anders, welcome to the World Transformed.
Thank you.
Well, we're delighted to have both of our panelists this evening, and we're going to be going through a series of questions about accelerating change in the technological singularity. And as we've noted throughout this series, we'll be talking less about what these things are and more about why we should be concerned about them, what impact, what interest they would have to us as individuals, what interest they have to us as a society. So, Stephen, why don't you kick it off?
Absolutely, absolutely. My question is this. How can we expect accelerating technology to impact our lives in years to come, and will it lead to the kind of scenario that Bernard Benji described? Anders, would you lead off with that?
Yes. It's interesting to see how rapidly the technologies we rely on change. Right now, for example, we're very much relying every day on smartphones and GPS technologies, which didn't exist in an economical form just 10 years ago. And in addition, of course, many of the technologies which we get used to, we imagine that they have been around forever, like search engines or the social network systems. So we can expect that similar technologies will arrive at an increasing pace, and we will try to think of, well, we will adjust to them very rapidly. The problem is, of course, that previous generations who do not adjust very much will be left behind. We will notice various increasing gaps between people who use different media. I'm already noticing that I'm not texting as much as some of my younger friends. And, of course, their younger friends think that, why are you texting when there is Twitter?
I've noticed that as well. Absolutely.
It's hard to imagine, but we've reached a point where email is an old-fashioned form of communication that you can show your age actually by relying on a telephone or email to communicate with others, such as the rapid adoption of other alternatives.
And the interesting thing is, we're very good at adopting new technologies at a more and more rapid pace. There are probably limits on how quickly you can learn a user interface, but we haven't seen them yet. And, of course, the user interfaces I've been talking about are computing systems, but since we're putting an electronic or digital user interface on all our technologies, a lot of new possibilities become accessible at a very fast clip.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Philip, let me just throw the question to you. Can we expect, or how can we expect, accelerating technology to impact our lives? And do you think it gets us to the sort of singularity that Bernard Benji was talking about?
Well, with my focus on looking at these things from a societal and cultural perspective, I notice that these changes, these hyper-accelerating changes, are already with us and have been with us for some time. I notice in particular the continued shortening of adoption periods of products and services, the time for the diffusion into society of new technologies like radio, television, cars, and then cell phones and personal computers and tablets, etc. These adoption periods are just keeping on being compressed, and one wonders where that will end up. It's not just the adoption periods that I notice continuing as shortening. It's also the product obsolescence times. They are engineered into new products and services to be supplanted by newer ones at an ever accelerating pace. Like, look for how brief a period we've had Facebook, and now Google Plus is already well on its way in taking it over. And on the individual side, or perhaps it's still the societal side, I'm also noticing some arguably pathological or pathologization of some of these trends. For instance, I'm noticing a continued shortening of attention spans, especially with younger people. But even I notice it with myself. It's ever more problematic to stay focused for longer periods and not to be distracted by the plethora of entertainments and other seductions hoisted at us. Now, in terms of whether I expect a change or a frightening scenario like that espoused by Werner Vinge, well, the scientifically accurate answer, of course, is I don't know. But my hunch is that there's going to be a big transition period ahead of us. I don't know how long that transition period is, and perhaps, even probably, we are already in that transition period. My suspicion is that it will be, in hindsight, a couple decades, perhaps shorter, maybe one decade, but a big transition period from a pre-nanobio-infocogno convergence to a post-nanobio-infocogno convergence world. And is it possible that it will be a sea change and that we won't recognize the world afterwards? Yeah, it's possible, but I think it's more plausible that it will not be that dramatic a change, at least not to the people who are riding that wave. You know, in hindsight, with a distance of a couple hundred years, we might look back and say, oh yeah, that was a singularity, you know, that couple of decades there. But for the people riding that wave, I think it's not going to be as frightening and as dramatic a change as Werner Vinge seems to think. That doesn't mean that it will be pleasant sailing throughout. I do think this transition period is going to be painful in some aspects for society and individuals. There will be disruptions, societal, economic, and other disruptions brought about by these hyper-accelerating changes, which people really need to not so much worry about them, but they need to know about them. They need to take them seriously enough to start getting prepared, because as Lord Baden-Powell said, you know, you've got to be prepared. And so instead of worrying about it or being frightened, the better stance, I think, is taking it seriously enough and seeing what you can do to start changing, to adapt to this big wave of change, and start adapting to it and then get ready.
Okay. Well, Anders, let me get back to you on that issue. Does accelerating change get us to something that could fairly be described as a technological singularity? What do you think?
I think there are many different words I think there are many different concepts that we call the singularity, and it might be useful to disentangle them a bit. So on one hand, we have accelerating technological change, and then we have the issue of whether we can predict what lies beyond that. But there is also this idea of a singular event, maybe a change over a very short period of time. And the very interesting question, will this involve some form of superintelligence? Well, that seems to be the most likely thing to actually drive a really big singularity that really changes the rules. And I think we're certainly seeing accelerating change. And it might be that we're just getting to a good old-fashioned science fiction future with starships and the flying cars eventually, maybe in the really long run.
And that'll be fine if we get to that. That sounds great to me, by the way.
Yeah. It's a very safe future, and many people would probably be very happy. Oh, yes, we live a really long time because we take our food tablets and everything is shiny and streamlined. On the other hand, the unsettling aspect of Vinge's concept is, well, our technology also helps us make new technology in a more rapid clip. And especially when technology itself can make new technology, we're going to get a runaway intelligence of some kind. It might be a bit like a robot, it might be humans who are very enhanced, or it might be something very abstract, like Google suddenly turning very smart and taking charge of economy. But it would still be this weird, diffuse power that we don't really notice and we can't really understand, just as we can't really understand what's going on in finance these days. Now, that is much more scary because humans are not in charge. Rather, we're part of something much bigger that we can't really make out individually. And that is much more unsettling. I personally think that, that is a real possibility. I do not know how to assign a good probability to it, but it would be stupid to say it cannot happen. Because in all the models I've been working on and comparing, it seems that as soon as you get economies of scale on in making new intelligence, you almost inevitably get things blowing up, increasing extremely rapidly to whatever limits are set by the resources or the laws of physics. And while that's not going to be an instant thing, it might still take decades, perhaps, it's still a very abrupt change in history.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about those two possible scenarios, one being the accelerating change scenario and the other one being the kind of massive, disruptive, sudden event, those being two possible ways of framing the singularity. And Anders, getting back to your earlier answer, talking about how quickly we adapted our thinking to search engines and to social networks and, you know, when you think about it, all kinds of things, to mobile telephony and then to smartphones. You could go back 20 years ago and look at this world we're in and say, wow, that's really radically different. But for the people living in it, it doesn't feel that terribly different. And likewise, you can posit that people who arrive in that accelerating change singularity, per Philip's description, might not find that they've really experienced what we would think of as a singularity. They've simply seen a lot more technological development, and they're living in this really interesting world. But let's take that second scenario, that massive disruptive change scenario, and I want to talk about what people's attitudes towards that should be, what people's knowledge of that information interest level in that realistically should be. We had the show about existential risk last week, and we talked about there's some categories of risk that that we should be involved in and we should be thinking about and working to try to mitigate and prevent, and then there are some that cosmic radiation from a star going nova that we're really not going to be able to do a heck of a lot about for any foreseeable period of time, so there's probably no point in spending a lot of time thinking about those. So the question is, should the average listener of The World Transformed 2, or just the kind of hypothetical average person, should they be concerned about that second model of the singularity? Should they be concerned about this big disruptive future that lies on the horizon? And if so, how ought they to be preparing themselves for that? Anders, why don't we start with you on that one?
I think in general one should always be a bit concerned that there might be big disruptions on the horizon. It's just that it's usually very hard to predict which disruption one might look for. So it's very useful individually to construct a resilient lifestyle that it actually can handle a few knocks. But we also need to construct resilient societies. But the deep problem, which is of course so annoying with the singularity, is that if you get a kind of super intelligent singularity, we would really like to then know beforehand about the properties of it, and we only got human brains. Still, we might be able to say some things. The philosopher Nick Bostrom has pointed out that when you're in a chess game against a chess supercomputer or a grandmaster, you might not be able to predict the moves, but you know you're most likely going to lose the chess game against him. So you can say certain things about superintelligences, and it might be very useful to actually spend some effort as societies today to actually figure out as much as we can about how to handle superintelligences and other very rapid forms of radical change. But individually, I think the best solution is to adopt a, well, resilient lifestyle and be aware that, well, things might change and I should learn how to adapt to radical change.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Philip, what do you think? Same kind of response as you gave earlier to the more gradual singularity, or should people be thinking about preparing themselves for this more disruptive kind of singularity?
Well, I think people should take it seriously enough and be aware that it's a real possibility and that extremely disruptive change in a very short time span could be, within their personal foreseeable future, near term, medium term. At the same time, I don't think the kind of, oh, that's horrible, I'm frightened, attitude would be very helpful here. On the contrary, I think I would recommend or advise calmness, and especially looking at the hard science about or behind the notions of singularities. I mean, let's not forget, Werner Vinge was a professor of mathematics and a wonderful science fiction author that he still is. And, of course, in nature, singularities do occur in physical nature, and they are things that you don't want to be anywhere near to. There are things like the Big Bang and black holes. And so that's, I think, the mathematician in Werner Vinge that said, you know, I know what singularities look like in mathematics and in physical reality, and if this technological singularity is going to be anywhere near that. He said so himself explicitly. You know, he would prefer to look at the technological singularity a few thousand years or 100 years removed rather than facing it as something that may happen within his lifetime. The counter to that is that the singularity, I find the word itself actually a bit technically inaccurate or at least inappropriate, because it brings in these overtones and these expectations of what singularities are in physical nature, because what we're really talking about here is a quote-unquote singularity, or something that looks like a singularity, as John von Neumann pointed out, that looks like a singularity, but it's really a cultural or a societal singularity. And we should be reminded, again, from the mathematical camp, that in nature, nothing follows a pure exponential. So applying expectations of pure exponentials in terms of hyperaccelerating change to apply to society, that's just not on. That's not proper science. And people should be aware of that the term technological singularity is really a cultural way of dealing with this hyper-accelerating change, and that it's a metaphor. Perhaps other words would be more appropriate. And I'm reminded of the celebrated information theorist John von Neumann himself, who is referenced as one of the earliest people mentioning the word singularity for this hyper-accelerating change. He himself, in the quote by Ulam, said that the ever-accelerating process of technology, and I'm quoting now, gives the appearance of approaching some central singularity. So, that's really different from saying, in a very positive manner, the singularity is near. Neumann's comment really strongly hints at an illusion of perception, whereas the other way of putting it presents a rather strong, positive forecast as a fact.
So it remains important for us to make that to make that distinction around exactly what it is we're talking about.
Correct.
Philip, you advise calm, but that's not the same as saying don't be concerned. Let me just ask this. What are the major risks that individuals or societies, and maybe even our civilizations or species, what risk could we face if we are not singularly aware or not aware of accelerating technological change? Is there are there risks in not facing these scenarios?
Yes, I do think there are risks, and it has all to do with the capability of an individual and of societies to absorb change. And our societies and individuals are becoming ever more sorely tested in their capability at absorbing change at an ever faster rate, you know, with these shortening adoption cycles, shortening obsolescence, etc. So that's really where the risk is. And for people who are not aware of this phenomenon of absorption of change, etc., they can really be surprised in an unpleasant way with stuff coming from left of field for them and surprising them in nasty ways. Some of them would be, for instance, the economic disruptions of, for example, manufacturing, which would put a lot of people over time, would put a lot of people out of work. So some of those people who are not seeing this coming and who are not preparing to retrain for other jobs might find themselves out of a job for a long time due to this disruptive abundance of nanotechnology, or nanofacturing to be more precise. Now, it's not because you're informed and aware of these changes coming that you're going to get through this scot-free. I mentioned it earlier, I am suspicious of what I call a pathologization of this requirement of individuals and societies to absorb changes and ever more changes ever faster. We're really being tested, and the truth is we are not, by evolution, we are not equipped to deal with this amount of change in that short amount of period. So there's going to be damage, and I think the pathologies will emerge and perhaps are already emerging both in mental health and in physical health, which will be more or less directly related to the ability, or rather the disability, the dysfunctioning of individuals and societies in coping with these accelerating changes. So people will be affected mentally, and this has been very vividly illustrated in major science fiction works like Johnny Mnemonic and Snow Crash, where the imagination speculated about how, you know, information technology might somatize into actual physical dysfunctions and physical health and physical in the brain or in other parts of the body, and definitely affect mental health. So you need to be aware that everybody, I think, needs to be aware that it's coming. If you don't know that it's coming, the damage that you're going to suffer is going to be worse. And but even those who know that it's coming should be aware that the risk of damage or downsides from this period of transition, this transition period towards a post-nanobio-infocogno-converged world, is going to be painful and may inflict damage.
Okay. Anders, what is the danger to individuals or societies that don't ride the wave? If we don't, you know, we don't successfully transition from email to texting to Twitter to telephone, we just choose to get off the wave. What's the danger to us?
Well, I think the transition between different media shows a good demonstration of a problem society is increasingly having. For a very long period, we had written text, and we developed laws and norms surrounding how written text were to manage. Then we got telephones, and we developed social norms to deal with how people were to answer in the phones, what laws are applicable to phone calls, threats across phone calls, and so on. Then we got computers and email. And now we had a much faster adaptation. We had less time to actually develop good norms. But the time it takes to figure out a good law, for example, to deal with spam, is about the same time as it would be to construct a law to deal with phone calls, which was more than enough for phone calls, a bit trickier for email, because by the time we started getting laws against email spam, other media had already shown up with their own interesting problems and abilities. So what we're getting is that the technology is changing much faster than we can develop social norms to deal with it. After all, remember all the conflicts we're still having about when it's appropriate to be using cell phones, not to mention texting. And the legal system we have is deliberately set to be relatively slow, and that means that it cannot keep up. Now, the problem here is also that the political generations we have in politics across the Western world, they are moving at a relatively slow pace. And they're, of course, a bit out of pace of the technological question. So by the time a law has been passed, the technology have already moved several technology generations ahead. So there is a real risk that our institutions, both governments, but also kind of informal institutions, can't keep up with the technology. Some people are adopting, some people are inventing new ways of dealing with it, but the kind of overall joint societal attempts of handling it get more and more out of touch. The solution to that is, of course, to develop new, more agile institutions. We have no clue how to do that right now, but we definitely need to try it, because we're going to need more and more new agile institutions and new ways of improving adaptation of society, especially since we don't really know what is going to be happening as we approach a period of faster time. It's pretty likely that we're going to get a bunch of interesting disasters with any new technology. And in order to survive that, of course, we need institutions who can actually pick up the pieces and learn from those lessons and then move onwards. The real problem is, of course, that most institutions try to protect themselves. They try to maintain their structure. Most people involved in these institutions have invested a lot of time and effort of reaching their positions, which means that they're going to try to maintain the institution as it is. And that is, of course, going to mean that most institutions are going to be too slow. Figuring out what the other forms of organization we can set up, I think that is one of the primary challenges as we approach the singularity.
You know, it's interesting when you mention these social adaptations that we've attempted to make, are attempting to make, in the process of making around technology. That I think about, you know, what's it polite to do in a restaurant? It's not considered polite to be talking on your cell phone. There's places where it's not considered polite to text. And I wonder if science fiction and just a general greater cultural interest in speculative fiction isn't one of the things that, in some sense, helps us to prepare for these things. I think about, you know, in the future, what will it be considered impolite to do, to bring your robot with you into a restaurant, right? Or to be in VR around people who aren't in VR, or, you know, it's fun to speculate about what those possible scenarios might be. And as soon as I thought of the idea of, well, it might be considered rude to bring your robot with you into a restaurant, I remembered that the original Star Wars from 1977 actually had a scene where the barkeep said, "Your droids aren't welcome here, right? They have to stay outside." So people who enjoy or make science fiction part of their lives maybe have a leg up in terms of preparing themselves for that. And science fiction is definitely something that we've seen go increasingly mainstream over the last couple of decades, at least ideas from science fiction. I would like to see serious science fiction get more attention than just kind of you know, robot stories and spaceship stories and things like that. But last week we had Sonia Arison on talking about Singularity University, and that's one of our partners in presenting The World Transformed. And I think it's interesting that we can now see that not just technological enthusiasts and not just people with a real interest in the future, but business people and government leaders and others are beginning to realize that they need to be better educated about accelerating technological change. To me, that seems somewhat encouraging. So I suppose the question is, Anders, is the singularity going mainstream? And if so, do you think, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's indeed going mainstream. People are recognizing that things are changing. However, there is a difference between recognizing that things are changing and thinking very carefully about it, because it's much easier to go into the old tropes of apocalyptic thinking or assuming that, oh, everything is going to be all fine, rather than the future is getting here now and it's extremely weird. So I think, in general, the mainstream view of singularity quite often tends to be shorn of all its details. And then it turns into a Pollyanna view that, okay, we're going to get some kind of acceleration of the market, we're going to get more new technology, but not really that it changed how things work. If you consider how social media allows people to organize globally in completely different ways, how clashes between culture now occur online in very strange way, and when you get new weird memes turning into little subcultures practically daily, that's not really part of its standard store of just better technology. So I think we have a problem that most of the mainstream views of singularity still lack that detail, that the future is different. People think that the future might be more, and hope might be more in a good manner, but not that it's going to be weird, strange, different. If you consider somebody from 1900 brought to 1950, he would be really impressed by the technological advances. Cars everywhere, shining skyscrapers, and even telephones in every home. But if it was somebody from 1950 was brought to the year 2000, he would be even more shocked. He would recognize the technology, but not the social mores. Then acceptance of gays, the idea that women actually are equal, a completely globalized culture, that's much more scary than just a few shiny streamlined cars. And over the next 50 years, we're probably going to see social shifts that are going to make the past 50 years look positively normal.
Interesting, interesting prediction. Now, what do you think, Philip? Is the singularity going mainstream? And if so, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
The short answer is yes, it's going mainstream. But before I discuss that, I'd like to make an observation on what Anders just said. He's right. The mainstream media don't give the detail that's needed about the singularity or quote-unquote singularity. But there are two trends which are not helping at all to get that detail from mainstream media. One is the shortening attention spans, which I already mentioned, and the other is the nature of broadcast media, which just do not allow for shading and detailing of the kind that is needed for a sophisticated or minimally sophisticated understanding of these hyper-accelerating changes that are upon us. Now, when I said that the singularity is going mainstream, I said yes, but I'm not. And whether or not that's a good thing, I think it's better that it's going mainstream than that it would be totally ignored or not on the radar at all. However, all is not well in this space, because my perception is that the understanding or the portrayal of the singularity in mainstream media, as well as in scientific or science fiction rather movies, is shallow. It's kind of a cardboard image, a stand-up, if you like, of the real thing, just two-dimensional instead of three-dimensional or hyper-dimensional, as would probably be more appropriate. So my sense is that even though there are some science fiction movies, intelligent science fiction movies out there who do make some really good points and be highly recommended viewing for any intelligent person thinking about the times that they live in, even there, you have this majority of the population which unfortunately associates science fiction still with this just no way attitude. You know, the majority of the population, when they look at science fiction tropes and memes, etc., they go, it's fun, it's entertaining, but yeah, just no way. You know, things will simmer down and it's not going to be as bad as that. And so So I think we have a lot of work still to be done to raise public awareness and to do public education as well as helping public policy development to wrap people's minds around this transition period that's coming or that we are already in, and to not instill panic or don't do any fear-mongering, but make sure that people are as informed as possible about the different perspectives on these trends, on these phenomena. Make clear that not everybody agrees or understands these changes in the same way, and help people to pick and choose idiosyncratically or as they wish from this smorgasbord of perceptions on what's afoot. And I really frankly have a concern there. I don't see it happening early enough, and I don't see it happening well enough. I think we're going to end up with the majority of the planet's population not sufficiently informed, and some of them, alas, totally uninformed about these changes and these trends and this hyper-accelerating change and the transition period. And I think we're going to have truly frightened people, or people suffering from the deep disruptions of their lives, their livelihood, etc., that we're going to see serious, widespread societal dissociation, and at the very least, I'm hoping that enough decision makers, corporate decision makers, and public policy decision makers, politicians, will be made sufficiently aware of this and take it sufficiently seriously, so that when these dislocations, these societal dislocations happen, that they at least can try and deal with it with a correct framework in the back of their mind to understand what's happening and what's driving these disruptions.
You know, it's hard to imagine that moving into this era that we're moving into would not involve a certain amount of almost trauma due to the level of disruption. I did a blog piece, it's been a couple, 3 years ago now, and it was really interesting juxtaposing quotes from, one was from Ray Kurzweil, one was from Stephen Hawking, and one was from the CTO of a major corporation, I can't remember which one it was, but each one was talking about how much change would occur in the 21st century relative to how much we'd been through in previous centuries. And one of the interesting things about that was Ray actually came off as kind of the conservative out of that bunch. But all three of them, Stephen Hawking, Ray Kurzweil, and the executive with the company who slips my mind, all were talking in terms of hundreds, if not thousands, of years worth of change potentially occurring over that 100-year span. So taking it back, Anders, to your comparison of the person brought from the year 1900 to the year 1950 versus the person brought from the year 1950 to the year 2000. Yeah, you take somebody from the year 2000 and put them in the year 2050, no telling what they're going to be facing. Although I have to say that the mention that you made of the change in social norms gives us some inkling of the kind of massive change. You know, I was talking about whether you could bring your robot into a restaurant. I can only imagine that people will be marrying their robots before 2050, if not more shocking changes than that. Well, all of that leads us to the question of where does it all lead? And I think we have time for one more question. So, Stephen, what do you got?
Okay. Well, next week we're going to be talking with author Kevin Kelly, and he has expressed some discomfort, Philip, with the with the term, if not the concept, of the technological singularity. But in his book, What Technology Wants, he describes what is going to be happening as the infinite game, and he talks about the future of humanity potentially being an infinite opening up of possibilities for happiness, fulfillment, and meaning. Would you use similar terms to describe what, you know, if all goes well, accelerating technology represents for us?
I wouldn't use the exact same terms. Again, what I said earlier about the mathematics nature, nothing follows a pure exponential, even though there are singularities within physical nature. That word infinite bothers me because we don't experience real infinities in our pedestrian day-to-day lives. So at the same time, I do share Kevin Kelly's sentiment. I'm fundamentally optimistic. I think we have a huge challenge ahead of us. This transition period, that's a biggie, and it will create techno-obesity and techno-indigestion, and it will hurt, and there will be disruptions. It's not going to be pretty, and we need to do our very best to alleviate the foreseeable disruptions and perhaps even try and foresee some not-so-foreseeable disruptions. But when we have gotten through that transition period, and I think my gut level sense says that we will get through this as a human civilization, and we will digest and process this and internalize these huge changes upon us. And I think on the whole, the lives of most people at the far side of this transition period will be dramatically better. I think people will still get bored, and the mundane, etc., will not have disappeared from our enhanced lives. But still, you know, it's going to be better. I mean, look, the comparison I love is if you look at the lifestyle of even lower middle class people in the Western world, in the United States and in Europe and in Japan, etc., if you compare that to the lifestyle of kings and emperors, even just a few hundred years ago, that lower middle class is living way better than those kings and emperors. And, you know, now do a transposition of that kind of difference to the world after the transition period. And I think, you know, people after the transition will live very much better than we are living now. And we are already living much better than people, kings and emperors of a few hundred years ago. So I think we have a lot to look forward to. There will be a price to pay. The transition is not going to be easy, but it's going to be well worth it, and I look forward to it.
Anders, what do you think? Are you closer to Kevin Kelly's infinite game or Bernard Benji's technological singularity in your outlook on the future?
I think there are many different possibilities, and in many ways I want more possible futures. I'm very worried if all of our history would be funneled through some kind of bottleneck where a single mistake could lead to a total disaster. I would feel much more comfortable if I knew there were space colonies out there, so if we messed up the singularity on Earth, at least the Mars base could continue. But I think we will indeed muddle through the technological singularity, and most likely that will lead to an enormous Cambrian explosion of diversity in whatever comes afterwards. We do not know how radical the singularity could be in terms of changing our lives. It could merely be that we end up after a period of a bit of turbulence in a shiny, streamlined 50s future. Or it could be an evolutionary transition, producing something that's so far different from us that we would correspond to trilobites to whatever intelligence there are there. But again, that argument that, well, it's better to live today as a normal middle-class person than to be a king in the Middle Ages, I think that applies across a very big part of history. If I were to get a chance to soon live a life of somebody in the Roman era, I wouldn't take it, because life was brutish, nasty, and short. And I would certainly not want to live as, let's say, a primate or an early mammal. And it might actually be that trend continues. So I do actually believe that we have a kind of long-term progress. mainly because the space of possibility is so large. And we're exploring more and more parts of that possibility space. And some parts of that, as we know from our normal life, are extremely good. And I think we're going to find in the post-singularity world areas that are so good that you can't currently even imagine them.
Well, I love that. I love that description, and I think we're going to have to make that the parting thought for the panel discussion segment of our program. I'd like to say thank you to both of our panelists for sharing your perspectives with us this evening. What a wonderful discussion! Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We will now switch to our second segment, our discussion with Ray Kurzweil, previously recorded.
Ray Kurzweil is an inventor, futurist, visionary, and best-selling author. He's been described as the restless genius by the Wall Street Journal and the ultimate thinking machine by Forbes. Inc. magazine ranked him number 8 among entrepreneurs in the United States, calling him the rightful heir to Thomas Edison. And PBS included Ray as one of the 16 revolutionaries who made America, along with other inventors of the past two centuries. Ray has written 6 books, 4 of which have been national bestsellers. To mention 2 that have been particularly influential for us at The Speculus and Fast Forward Radio, The Age of Spiritual Machines has been translated into 9 languages and was the number 1 best-selling book on Amazon in science. The Singularity is Near was a New York Times bestseller and has been the number 1 book on Amazon in both science and philosophy. Ray, it's a real pleasure and honor to welcome you once again to The World Transformed.
Likewise, look forward to our conversation.
So, Ray, what I thought we would do is, obviously, we want to talk about the singularity, but as you know, our emphasis in The World Transformed 2 is not so much on defining what these transformations are, but talking about how they're going to impact individuals or how they'll impact society and how our lives are going to be different. So let's start with this question. What are the major trends that people are witnessing in their day-to-day lives today that indicate the coming of the singularity? How can you draw a line from what we're seeing today to the singularity?
It's interesting how quickly people get used to changes and it becomes part of everyday reality and they forget that the world was ever different. But if you go back just a few years, there were no social networks, no wikis, no blogs. Go back maybe a decade, and most people didn't use search engines. I mean, imagine that. Sounds like ancient history.
But it's hard to imagine living without a search engine. It really is.
And it was very interesting watching Social Network, where there's all these quaint computers and ways of using personal computing, and they were excited when 100 people used Facebook in the world, and that was 2004. So the world is changing very quickly. We really have the whole world at our fingertips, and a kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more knowledge than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. And,
wow.
And these are very powerful enabling tools. I mean, what fantastic tool enabled Zuckerberg to create Facebook? It was his $1,000 laptop, and he had $19,000 of investment capital. What tool enabled Larry Page and Sergey Brin to create Google from a late night dorm room challenge? It was just kind of a math hack that done in the middle of the night. It was their laptops. So these, and we will see not only college kids, but very soon we'll see high school kids and junior high school kids creating these kinds of revolutionary changes. They have the tools and we have the access to the market. You don't have to be a big corporation to change the world, start even political revolutions. I mean, I wrote in the 80s that the Soviet Union, which was then going strong, would be swept away by the then emerging social network. I didn't call it that. I called it decentralized electronic communication. And people thought that was ridiculous, that the Soviet Union, a mighty superpower built to last centuries, it seemed, would be swept away by a few teletype machines, but that's exactly what happened in that 1991 coup against Gorbachev. And we saw a great rise of democratization during the 1990s, and we're seeing it continuing today with social networks. If you go back, some decades, say 40 years ago, there were very few democracies in the world. So people get hung up on how things move from week to week, and the economy goes up and down 1 or 2 percentage points in the period of a quarter, that creates headlines. They lose sight of these very broad trends. And there's, you know, a lot of controversy, you know, is technology good or bad for society? And there's a strong school of thought that thinks that it's the root of all evil. And I invite people to read Thomas Hobbes or even Charles Dickens as to what life really was like 200 years ago before we had the tools we have today. It was, Thomas Hobbes described it as short, brutish, disaster-prone, disease-filled, poverty-filled. That was the fate of almost everyone. And these changes are coming faster and faster, and underlying that is the exponential growth of information technology, which we can get into, but this sort of dry data, which I've been collecting, showing exponential growth in these basic measures of information technology, translate into real changes in people's lives. You see it walking through an airport, your kids, 8, 10 years old, they're in touch with their fellow children around the world in an unsupervised network, which is quite revolutionary and I think very educational.
It's a hugely different world for sure. You know, you mentioned the social networks, and I hear a hint of a spin on the role that they play, which is different than what we hear from the mainstream media. There's been a lot made over changes, political changes that have occurred in the Middle East and situations that are still occurring there, and more recently about the riots that occurred in London, about social networks and smartphone technologies as being kind of these enabling technologies for these political shifts that are occurring. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is they're not only enablers, but in a real sense they're kind of the cause or the drivers of some of these shifts. Is that a fair thing to say?
I mean, knowledge is power. Lao Tzu said that 2,000 years ago. And so if young people in Egypt or Libya or anywhere see how people live and organize themselves and see what their cultures are around the world, they want to be part of that. And that's a very powerful force. It's not just political. It's at every level of society. A young woman goes into her doctor's office. She has a chronic disease. She's in touch with people all around the world and is up on all the latest information about that condition, and, you know, may very well know more about it than her doctor because he's not just tracking one condition. It changes their relationship. I mean, if that doctor's going to be useful, he has to be a wise guide and mentor more than the sort of repository of all knowledge. Same thing's happening in education. We don't need to stuff facts into kids' heads, this kind of rote learning, which is still, you know, dominant in around the world, is completely useless. I remember the controversy, this was around the time I went to college, that, you know, these calculators which were emerging would mean the kids would stop learning arithmetic. And,
right.
And we seem to have survived that, and I think kids don't necessarily need to know the mechanics of arithmetic any more than they need to know script handwriting. The equipment to do those things is not going away, and we've outsourced our memories to our devices, both our personal memories and our social and historical memories. It's a perfectly good place for it. We need to teach kids how to solve real-world problems. I'm a big believer in bringing entrepreneurship into the schools, not for its own sake, but also that's the best way to learn. I mean, if I think about what I've managed to learn in my life, it's from doing projects that I had a passion for. And I wasn't necessarily passionate about, I'm going to learn something about AI or about scanning technology. I had a passion to accomplish something, to enable the blind to read, say. But along the way, you actually have to learn some things.
Ray, last week we talked just a little bit about existential risk. And, you know, we came to the basically conclusion that there's some existential risk that not worth worrying too much about if you can't do anything to change it. You know, if a star goes supernova close enough to us, we not much we can do about that. Likewise, is the singularity something that people need to be engaged in, worried about, or care about? Is it a little like winning the lottery? It just it will happen or it won't happen, but it, nothing we do has much effect upon whether it happens or not.
Well, I think it's very important that everyone understand where we're headed and help to shape it. They say war is too important to leave to the generals, but technology is too important to leave just to technologists. Technology is a double-edged sword. I mean, fire cooked our meals and warmed our homes, but was also used to burn down our villages. And it's always been a double-edged sword. You know, you don't have to look further than the 20th century to see that. We had 180 million people die in the wars of the 20th century. So, you know, I make a strong point that it is inevitable that these basic measures of information technology, the power of computing, MIPS per dollar, will grow exponentially. The number of bits of communication we do wirelessly or on the internet grows exponentially, and it does so inexorably, and it goes through thick and thin and war and peace and boom times and recessions. And so then people say, oh, well, it's going to happen anyway. Why don't we all just sit back and let it happen? Because if we all did that, then it wouldn't happen. So, I mean, what it is that we can count on is that enough people will have a passion to advance knowledge. But the other reason to care about it is the issue you brought up, to really help shape these technologies and move them in a constructive direction. There's a large relinquishment movement. For example, Bill McKibben, who's the first to write about global warming, wrote a book called Enough, which basically translates into enough already. You know, technology's been a good thing, but enough is enough, and we have as much benefit as we need. And besides, these new technologies are very dangerous. And then he goes on quite extensively in the book to cite the dangers by quoting my own writings, because I have been very active in describing what these downsides are. But where I part company with Bill is on the prescription. I think relinquishment is a bad idea for three reasons. It would deprive us of profound benefits we still need. There's still a lot of suffering in the world. I don't think we want to tell all the cancer patients we're on the verge of major breakthroughs, but we're canceling all that because that technology might be abused. Secondly, it would require a totalitarian system to implement a ban on technology. That was the moral of Brave New World. And thirdly, it wouldn't work. It would just drive these technologies underground where they'd be even more dangerous and would deprive responsible scientists of the tools that they need to create defenses. And that is the heart of my strategy, to have ethical standards like the Asilomar guidelines we have in biotech, which have worked very well for a quarter century, to prevent accidental problems, and then to prevent intentional problems like bioterrorism, to actually have a rapid response system. And a good example of where we've done that well is in software viruses. We just sat back and said, oh, well, no one would ever put out a harmful software virus. Why would anybody want to do that? The internet wouldn't last a minute. But actually, nobody's taken it down for a minute over the last 10 years. It's been a very robust system because we do have a technological immune system. And I've actually been working with the Army on developing similar system for biological viruses. We could talk for a long time about the technical details, but the ideas exist. But where society comes in is we need to put a collective priority on developing those defenses, developing technology in a way that keeps it safe. We certainly can define, you know, disaster and existential risk scenarios with nanotech and AI and so on. You don't have to look further than most science futures and movies to see the dangers of artificial intelligence. And those dangers are real, but I don't think we can avoid them by saying, okay, let's ban AI. Because, I mean, that basically amounts to let's ban technology, and it's just not viable. It's not the moral and ethical approach.
and our defenses have to grow with the technology at the same time. Yeah,
that's absolutely right. I mean, we can't say, okay, you know, we've succeeded in preventing software viruses from destroying the internet. We can cross that off our list of things to worry about. It's done. You know, as soon as you have a defense, it's already obsolete. And there's a lot of, you know, serious, literature on, you know, does offense or defense have an edge? And some people make a point that, offense has the edge. And it would have the edge if, you know, the world were equally divided and half wanted a constructive world and half were terrorists who wanted to destroy the world. So it's 50-50, it's equal on both sides, I think we'd be in a bad situation. So part of what we're relying on is that the vast majority of people, you know, do believe in the golden rule and do want to see a better world. And that, but we do have to put significant effort into those outliers who, for whatever reason, will have an ideology that causes them to be destructive.
Ray, it appears that we're on the verge, perhaps, of taking the second dip in a double-dip recession, if not falling into a full-blown economic depression here in the United States. And the news elsewhere in the world is not particularly encouraging either. And looking back on the Great Depression, how does the law of accelerating returns operate during difficult economic times?
The remarkable thing is it's not affected at all by these trends or these economic phenomena. It's not affected by war or peace, by boom times or recessions. It did not slow down at all during the recent recession. And I mean, just look at how computer technology and communications technology and biological technologies and brain scanning and brain reverse engineering technologies are continuing to advance at an exponential pace and not slow down in the least by the economic recession. The curves I have on, you know, MIPS per dollar, which is a basic measure of price performance of computing, goes smoothly through the Great Depression. So these, and even if you just look at the economic data itself, you see exponential growth. You can if you zoom out to a 100-year graph, you can't even see the ripples of the recessions. You do see the Great Depression, but the curve actually snaps back to where it would have been had that never occurred in the first place. It did not cause a permanent slowing down of economic growth. So there's always a great deal of attention on this week's, this month's, and this quarter's statistics, and you know we're right to be concerned, and I'm concerned about these things also. But it's also important to have a broader perspective, not be completely consumed in the news of the month. And so another perspective is that these economic statistics completely ignore the 50% deflation factor of information technology implicit in the law of accelerating returns. If you buy a dollar of electronics today, it counts as a dollar of economic activity. If you bought a dollar of electronics in 1990, it counted as a dollar of economic activity. However, the dollar you spend today is going to buy $1 million, literally, of value circa 1990 of electronics or any other information technology. And that's a fantastic boost in actual performance, but that's not reflected in the economic statistics. Look at our own productivity. I mean, I have work groups now where 3 people in 3 weeks do what used to take 50 people 2 years. That's not reflected. An hour of labor is still an hour of labor, even though we do a great deal more because the tools are more powerful. And we're sort of putting these gains in both the numerator and the denominator, and they cancel each other out, and we don't even notice them. So then people say, okay, great. Just give you another example. I mean, you can buy an iPhone today that's twice as good for half the money. That's a fourfold increase in price performance as compared to 2 years ago.
Right.
That doesn't show up anywhere. And it's not just, you know, Apple products. It's every product that has to do with information technology. So then people say, okay, that's true for this sort of weird special world of little of gadgets and so forth. But it's not true of bread and bricks and mortar and housing. And so an important point I make, and consistent with your emphasis on this show of impact on people's lives, these other bread and butter issues are going to become information technologies. That's the transformation we're making. Health and medicine is doing that. It used to be hit or miss. It was a linear process. Now it's an information technology. We're reprogramming biology as the information process that it really is. It's now undergoing exponential growth. Three-dimensional printing will bring information technology and the law of accelerating returns to physical products. Cover of The Economist recently had a picture of a violin that was actually printed out in a three-dimensional printer, and it plays and plays well. And we can already make 70% of the parts of a three-dimensional printer on a three-dimensional printer, and that'll be 100% within 5 or 6 years. The scale of precision is getting finer and finer at a scale of at a rate of 100 3D volume per decade. So these will be nanotechnology by the 2020s, and we'll really be printing out just about everything we need. We can print out modules to snap together Lego style to create high quality housing for the developing world. There's actually a project along those lines at Singularity University. And we will have new food production techniques, vertical agriculture, where we grow food in AI-controlled buildings with no ecological damage because it recycles all the nutrients, including in vitro cloned meat without animals, hydroponic plants. So these are all extensive discussions, but the point is it's ultimately going to transform everything. But again, you know, a dollar will be considered to be worth a dollar, even though you could buy vastly more in the future than you could buy today with that dollar. And then there's the free source, open source movement, where you ultimately, I mean, already you can get, you know, open source movies and music and software and games. In the future, you'll have free open source modules to build solar panels and modules to build housing and violins and really pretty much everything you need. We will achieve the goals of communism, from each according to his ability, to each according to their need, for which forced collectivism was such a profound failure, through free enterprise and the open source movement and the law of accelerating returns.
You know, Ray, when you talk about the economic progress really that's occurred in light of technological development, it puts me in mind of what you said earlier about people look back and they don't really see how radically, how fundamentally things have changed. When you talk about the African kid with the smartphone that has access to more knowledge than the President of the United States, that kid's not a hypothetical. There are millions of people like that who are, you know, suddenly in an economy of an emerging economy of abundance that just didn't exist even a decade ago or a couple of decades ago, and that is going to take us, I think, in some pretty unexpected directions economically speaking.
Absolutely. There's another trend which it really causes people's perceptions to be different, which is so we have better knowledge of the problems. So when there's starvation in Ethiopia or a battle in Fallujah, we say it's, you know, in our living rooms now, it's on our palm tops, but we're there and we experience it. And because we're empathetic creatures, we feel, my God, the world is filled with violence and hatred and all these things because we see it. It's not that it didn't exist before. In fact, life was much harsher. We just didn't experience it. You know, if 30,000 people died in a battle in World War II. If you heard about it at all, it was on a grainy newsreel 3 weeks later in the movie theater. There was not the immediacy of experience. And so that makes people think, oh my God, the world is getting worse because the news is filled with problems. And we have such good technology to see them. Now, I think that's a good thing, because when we see a problem, we're motivated to try to do something about it. And we do things about it. Even casualties in war are down. I mean, I have a graph showing, we get very upset now, rightly so, about wars that kill hundreds or thousands of people. We don't have wars like we used to, like World War II, where 60 million people died. And we didn't experience it really with much immediacy.
I want to talk about I'm sorry, Stephen, just one other question I want to explore real quick around risk, kind of a follow-up to the question, Stephen, that you asked. What are the risks that we face, not if we relinquish technology, but just if we don't come to terms with accelerating technological development? Do I as an individual stand to lose, or what does society stand to lose if we're simply not engaged with that, if we're not thinking about it and trying to plan around it?
We do now a certain amount of mentoring of young startup companies and early stage investing, and so we get business plans, and I would say most of the plans that come in act as if the world's ever going to change again.
Right.
And, the world 3 or 4 years from now is going to be the same as it is now. Maybe cell phones will be a little smaller. Perhaps they imagine the next iteration of technology, but then their imagination fails them as if it's just going to stop. And one of my theses, and it's held up in real time for 30 years, and I've over 100 years of data in these information technologies, is that you can predict quite precisely, not necessarily the social impact or which products are going to succeed or which technical standard will prevail, but you can measure things such as the price performance of pixel displays and communications and the number of bits will be moving around. And so I ask people, okay, what are the underlying technologies that affect your business? Like right now I have an ebook business myself, and so we're affected by displays and mobile computing and processor technology and wireless communication. So we actually write out January 2012, July 2012, January 2013. This is what cell phones will look like. This is what mobile tablets will look like. And we go through that exercise, and even though I've been doing this for 30 years, I'm amazed. Wow, you mean mobile computing is going to be that different by 2013? But you look at it, and yes, that's what it's going to be. Let's make sure our own plans make sense for that period of time. A new technology may take 2 years to develop. That world's going to be very different in 2 years. You better plan it for that world, not the world today. It's like skeet shooting. You can't shoot where the target is when you pull the trigger. Now, that's not just true of technology businesses. I mean, any project now is profoundly affected by this phenomenon. I speak to many different groups, musicians, librarians, graphic artists, high school teachers. I mean, these are just some of the groups I've spoken to recently, and they're all profoundly affected by these things. At this music conference, National Association of Music Merchants, it looked and read and sounded like a computer conference with the enormously sophisticated gear that's computerized gear that's used in creating music, or same for graphic art, same for library science. So no matter what you're doing, your project and your endeavor is going to have to really make sense and plan for these changes, and you can predict very precisely what the underlying technologies will look like. It's an important planning tool, for individuals and projects. And in terms of, career development, the idea of you know, learn a trade and then practice that for 40 years and then retire, is just not the model anymore at all. You know, 10, 20 years from now, you're going to be doing something that's not even defined today. You're going to have to keep learning. You're not going to retire in 40 years because you'll be 65 or 70 and you'll look 30. So these are things you know, that individuals need to think about.
Last week, Sonia Arison spoke with us about the Singularity University. They're one of our partners, by the way, in presenting the World Transformed, and we're very grateful to them. But she told us that business people, government leaders, and others are beginning to realize that they need to have a better understanding, be better educated about accelerating technological change. Is the Singularity going mainstream? Do you feel like it's moving in that direction, the ideal?
Well, it's definitely going mainstream. I mean, it's been an enormous amount of mainstream attention. There was a cover story in Time magazine some months ago. The movie Transcendent Man has had well over 1 million downloads, and it's been the number 2 documentary on iTunes, and has been very successful, and lots of other examples like that. So, I mean, I've been talking about these things for 30 years, and the interest is growing exponentially, as it should, because people are, you know, the changes now are viscerally noticeable. So the, you know, the issue resonates. You know, people not so long ago, you know, ridiculed AIs, and they don't do that anymore. You know, when they watched Watson, they just got this visceral reaction. Wow, if you can do that, what is it again they can't do? Okay,
right.
there's some things they can't do today, but, you know, who can confidently say, define any task that it will never do or won't do, for, you know, pretty soon, you know, within a decade or two, say. You know, Google cars have driven 140,000 miles without human drivers in California, and this, there are examples now that are really convincing. The philosophical arguments continue. Oh, well, Watson is just programmed. It's just doing what it's been programmed to do. And it says, yeah, it's got, you know, like 200 different programs, and it's very hard to predict how that'll work out. Certainly the developers can't predict it. And who's just, and, you know, what is it about your own brain that's not operating like that kind of program? Also with hundreds of things going on simultaneously. So people understand that. Ironically, I gave a speech recently to middle school kids. These were sort of gifted science students, 12 and 13-year-olds that came in from around the country to a special conference. And they were very singularitarian in their attitudes and beliefs. Generally, you know, kids who are 12 or 13 kind of get it, even though you think they haven't been around that long to notice changes. They'll say things, oh yeah, you know, when I was 8, I couldn't do, you know, X, Y, Z. And they notice the changes even more than, you know, their parents do.
Absolutely. You know, more and more people being aware of how the accelerating change. I can't imagine the downside really, but it seems that everybody, you know, more people that are aware, it would seem to be a good thing. But is that a failure of imagination? is there a downside to it going mainstream?
There's an interesting issue which I've been thinking about, which I don't have a good answer for. It's easy to come up with some superficial answers. But some people, you know, you present this data to them, and part of my argument for my thesis is sort of a very extensive set of empirical data showing how, you know, in trend after trend and measurement after measurement, there's very consistent exponential growth if it's a basic information technology. And then I have a theoretical reason why this should be the case, but the theoretical reason and there's a mathematical treatment, the singularity is near, but that wouldn't be very interesting if it wasn't for the strength of the empirical case. So I present all this, and, you know, some people kind of get it and understand that this will continue and are able to wrap their minds around the fact that this will change a lot of things, including the nature of what it is to be human. And other people are absolutely resistant. They will accept, okay, well, maybe my cell phone will be a little smaller, but they fall off the horse at some point, you know, maybe pretty quickly in terms of their imagination of this. And I'm trying to say, what is it, you know, what characteristic accounts for these kind of two reactions? And it's not so much a continuum. It's really, if you were to plot this, it would be a double humped curve. People either kind of accept it or they reject it. And it's not intelligence. It's not education. It's not profession. It's not age. It's there aren't any easy sort of attributes that allow us to predict what a person's reaction will be to this particular phenomenon.
Okay.
You know, we have guests on Fast Forward Radio, and in fact, who have participated in the World Transformed, people who are affiliated with organizations closely associated with the topic of the singularity, of people who are involved in Foresight Institute or some of these other groups, Humanity Plus, and they are skeptical about the singularity. So, in your view, that skepticism derives not necessarily from an empirical analysis of the of the data, but maybe just as more of a visceral or emotional reaction to the idea, do you think? Or
yeah, I mean, I think people get attached to a certain philosophy of life and a certain conception of who they are and who humans are. And, you know, these changes are not going to stop. And I do talk about ultimate limits to, based on what we know about the laws of physics, the computation and communication. And the answer is, yes, there are limits, at least if you assume that we can't go beyond nano computing. But the limits are not very limiting. I mean, ultimately, we can create small computers that are trillions of times more powerful than the human brain. And so so if you realize that this exponential growth is going to continue, then things get more and more transformed. And I use the metaphor of falling off the horse, and people generally fall off the horse at some point. They just can't go beyond a certain conception, though. Okay, so maybe we'll be able to create modules to print out houses, and so on, but, you know, we're actually going to put these computers in ourselves. Okay, well, maybe we can put computers in ourselves, but we'll never be principally non-biological. And, well, maybe we can be principally non-biological, but, you know, we're never just going to be software entities. I mean, at some point, people, it just threatens their own philosophy too much. You know, a major point of philosophy and religion has been rationalizing death, which is sort of an ultimate ontological dilemma or looming disaster, which people have needed to rationalize. And so we've created elaborate philosophies to deal with that specter, and then people get very attached to them. And you know, Kierkegaard talked about this profound anxiety that's looming out there. And so people finally resolve that anxiety with some personal philosophy that assures them that this looming catastrophe is actually a good thing, and they learn to live with it. Then people are not going to easily give that up. And there actually are some structural reasons in the brain why people have a hard time accepting new ideas. We have a limited capacity in our neocortex, which is where we do our thinking. I'm writing a book on that now called How the Mind Works and How to Build One, and there are a billion pattern recognizers. They're like little Lisp machines, Lisp processors, and so I describe how this works, and the reason a child can learn things like languages more easily is they really have not filled out their neocortex yet, and so it's very easy for them to find new structures to learn this new material. As we get older, it's all filled up, and you have to do some garbage collection, which is, that is to say, free up some of these structures to learn something new. Well, these basic philosophies of life have permeated our neocortex and have used up lots of the space and conceptual structures in there. And people just do not have the capacity to turn that over and adopt a whole new philosophy at a certain point. And some people reach that point, you know, pretty early in life. I think, you know, a real key to being a creative thinker is an ability to continue to accept new perspectives and ideas. But that requires pruning away the old ones.
And that can be kind of a painful and difficult process.
Exactly.
So next week we're going to conclude this series with our discussion of human destiny. And one of our guests on that show is Kevin Kelly, who says that he's skeptical about the singularity, but he has a view about the future of humanity and technology, which at least in some ways sounds an awful lot like what we read in your books, Ray. In his book, What Technology Wants, Kevin describes technology as an infinite game, and he talks about the future of humanity potentially being an infinite opening up of possibilities for happiness, for fulfillment, and for meaning in our lives. Now, would you use similar terms in describing what the singularity potentially represents for our future, or how would you frame that?
Well, I agree with that. I think that's eloquent. Kevin Kelly has made interesting statements on both sides of this. And I think, in fact, one of the things I've discovered about the neocortex is it's quite feasible for us to have inconsistent ideas coexisting. There's no sort of consistency filter that kind of goes through and makes sure that all your ideas are consistent with one another. So people may have strongly felt views of tolerance of, say, you know, other races and religions and orientations and so on the one hand, and then also have racist views in their neocortex coexisting, and there's nothing that cleans that up or makes it consistent. In Transcendent Man, he's quoted, I think, quite effectively, is saying, well, he just doesn't see the precursors of the kinds of things I'm talking about in the time frame. You know, ability to radically extend human longevity within 40 years, he just doesn't see it. I completely agree with that if I thought that progress were linear and our intuition about the future, our unexamined intuition is linear. We actually have, it's another thing about the neocortex, it can anticipate the future. That's why we have one. So I can say, well, that animal's about to cross my path. I've got to take a different route. So we can predict the future. It's good for our survival. But those predictors are linear. And so when we apply them to things like technology expectations, people use a linear, their intuitive, linear, hardwired expectation. So Kevin Kelly looks at the current precursors, as he calls them, and says, well, he doesn't see the precursors for the kinds of changes I'm talking about in 30, 40 years existing yet. And that's an accurate analysis if the progress were linear, which is our, you know, unexamined intuition. But that's my primary point. The progress is exponential, and exponentials are shockingly fast at the end. You know, halfway through the Genome Project, we had done 1% of it, and people declared it a failure and said, look, you've done 1% in 7 years, it's going to take 700 years. And I said, no, we did 1%, we're almost done. So it's only 7 doublings from 100%, and it had been doubling every year and continued, and it was done 7 years later. So I think that's the difference. But the argument he makes is a very effective one. He doesn't go through this math or this analysis or any kind of argument. He just appeals to people's intuition that this is ridiculous. And it was ridiculous that the general project would be done. It was ridiculous that a multi-hundred million user internet would arrive in the late 1990s when you looked at the ARPANET in the 1980s connecting a few thousand scientists, and just sort of very effectively shrugging your shoulders and ridiculing these perspectives is really the most sort of pernicious argument that I face. And Kevin Kelly does a very effective job of that in Transcendent Man. But it's an expression of an unexamined intuition, and he applies it then inconsistently, and you just quoted a statement where he, I think, gets it.
And taking that thought onto the conclusion, if we were to put human destiny in your terms, if you know, swinging this back around to the proverbial average person who's looking ahead and thinking about the technological singularity, where does it all end? What happens to us as individuals in this coming future world?
Well, I think we'll keep our individuality, but we'll also be able to merge our identities. We take it for granted that a million computers can become one and then can become a million again. And in the world of information, we place more attention on the processes than the processors. Because it's definitely not a one-to-one mapping. You can have 10 processes running in one processor. You could have one process running on 1,000 processors. We care about the processes. And these processes are going to become more and more complex and rich and going to take on human characteristics. And in a movie I made, The Singularity is Near, Martine Rothblatt, I asked her, because I interviewed these different thinkers, what about the argument that we're just a software program? And she says there's nothing wrong with being just a software program. We're all just software programs. You know, you can take John Searle's arguments where he sort of ridicules the idea that a software program could be thinking, his sort of Chinese room. The man with the rule book is really just a computer, and the man is basically a CPU in this analogy.
Mm-hmm.
The rule book is a stored program, and he ridicules that that could actually understand anything or do anything that we would call thinking. So I took one of his essays and simply changed symbols, and I put neurotransmitter concentrations and inner neural connections. And just by making changes like that, it became a very effective argument that the brain is incapable of doing anything we would call thinking or understanding. And after all, there are mechanisms, and we can argue what they are, and I have one thesis that I'm presenting in this next book, but clearly it's following physical law, and there are processes there, and we can understand them and emulate them. In fact, we're already simulating them at ever finer precision. And the distinction between natural processes and software is going to dissolve in the future. And we're going to become increasingly non-biological, and the non-biological portion of our intelligence will ultimately predominate, and we'll also be intelligent enough to model what's the biological portion. We'll be putting computers in our bodies and brains. People are doing that already. You know, Parkinson's patients and so on. There was actually an article in the New York Times expressing concern about people hacking into the software that people are downloading into these neural implants. These are relatively primitive today. In the future, they'll be much more sophisticated. We'll be able to introduce them non-invasively, you talk to somebody in the year 2035, there will be a hybrid of biological, non-biological thinking. And the non-biological portion will not just be the nanobots in their brain and what that computation is doing, because they in turn will be, tapping into the cloud of computing. I mean, right now, if you use even your mobile device, its capability is amplified by the cloud. For example, language translation, voice-to-voice translation, or Google Voice, that's using the cloud computing. It's not doing it inside the phone. So already we're used to the idea that, devices do not do everything inside the device. Everything is tied into the cloud. So ultimately that's where our destiny is.
So our destiny is truly, in keeping with the title of the film, Transcendent Man, it's to transcend the existence that we currently occupy. Well, I like the combination of that idea of transcendence and the language we borrowed from Kevin Kelly earlier about opening up of infinite possibilities. It seems to me that that between those two things, humanity is potentially headed for a pretty good future.
Yeah, and that's not a new story. Scientists are very fond of trying to knock humanity off its arrogant pedestal. The world doesn't circulate around the Earth. Earth is just a humble planet around a routine star. We didn't descend from the gods. We descended from apes, and before that from worms. There's nothing special about humanity. This has been the Copernicus view, and of course Copernicus was literally correct about the planets. It's actually ironic that Barry Ptolemy made Transcendent Man, because my view is more Ptolemaic, in that there is something special about humanity. Not that the world literally revolves around us, but we are the species that transcends, and no other species, at least that we know about, does that. We didn't stay in the ground. We didn't stay in the planet. We didn't stay with the limitations of our biology. Human life expectancy was 23,000 years ago. And, that transcendence is going into high gear. That's what the singularity is all about.
We all get to be transcendent, man. That's awesome.
Exactly.
Well, we love that picture of the future. And Ray, we thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Thanks so much for being part of the World Transform too.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good discussion. Thanks.
And with those closing comments from Ray Kurzweil, that will bring this edition of The World Transformed to a close. I'd like to say thank you once again to all of our guests, Anders Sandberg, Philip von Nederveld, and Ray Kurzweil, for providing such a fascinating insight into accelerating change and the technological singularity.
We'd also like to say thank you to our partner organizations for helping to make this show possible. They are the SINS Foundation, the Foresight Institute, Humanity Plus, and the Singularity University. And now here's a special message from Humanity Plus.
We are very pleased and honored to list Humanity Plus as one of the partners bringing the World Transformed to you along with us. And I'm talking with Natasha Vita Moore, who is the chair of Humanity Plus, in addition to having been a guest on World Transformed 2. Hello, Natasha.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Well, Natasha, we want to talk a little bit about Humanity Plus. So why don't we start off just, could you give us a little bit of background on the organization and explain what Humanity Plus is?
Certainly. In its most basic element, Humanity Plus is a nonprofit organization that seeks to bring about informed knowledge to its members and to the public about how innovation and ingenuity affect the relationship between humans and technology. Currently, it is the leading international transhumanist organization, and it stems out of the formulation of XRP Institute and World Transhumanist Organization. So those two organizations were in existence some years ago, and both closed down, and together they have helped to form the new organization we call Humanity Plus.
Currently, can you say a word or two about the name Humanity Plus? What does that mean, and why is it significant for this group?
It means basically elevating the human condition, humanity plus. The converse would be humanity minus, going backwards in our advances. We look toward going forward in not only elevating the human condition, but also taking a look at the relationship between humans, humanity, our humaneness, and the future.
And why do you think that Fast Forward Radio or well-transformed listeners would be interested in learning more about humanity?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is that the issues we address concern the practical, the doable, and the theoretical issues of a transdisciplinarity in scope concerning human enhancement, which is a well-known transhumanist concern. This field engages emerging and speculative technologies that are researched and developed for the purposes of increasing the performative aspect of human physicality or the human body, and also augmenting the cognitive aspects of human thinking. These are the central issues that we face as we're looking at the emerging and speculative technologies and how they will affect us. This is the basic extending of the human lifespan beyond its normal state and increasing mental activities such as our memory. The field seeks a type of transformative human condition, one in which the historical lifespan is readdressed, restructured, sculpted, so to speak, and a time when we take a look at what is it meant to be a person, a human, and what is our personal identity, and further looking at our consciousness in relationship to being a physical agent in a biological form and the possibilities of becoming more of a post-human identity in multiple platforms existing in multiple environments, such as virtuality, artificial environments, synthetic environments, not just as an avatar, but as a living agent, as a personal continuous identity. This is one area where the organization of Humanity Plus worked diligently to provide the most accurate, reliable, and cutting-edge information to the public through its conferences, its website, and its magazine. Continually readdressing and questioning where we are, what we're doing, how we're treating ourselves, how we're treating the environment, what is the symbiosis of our relationship with the other animals, other life forms, other environments, and how can we more appropriately create a workable relationship, one that prepares us for continuous advancement as a species and as a consciousness, and also a respect for the relationship between ourselves and other life forms and the universe. These are issues that oftentimes when we think of transhumanism, we don't take into consideration, but they are important issues, and they're ones that we do ponder, we do create theories about, and we do look at how the technologies will affect this in the larger scope.
Absolutely. It's a much bigger picture. So for those who are interested, how can they get involved in Humanity Plus?
Well, some of the best ways to get involved are to join, basically. Go to the website and join. It's a very we're very considerate of people's purses these days, so the cost is minimal. In fact, you can do a monthly payment of just short of $5, or you can do short of $30, depending on what your status is. That's one way and an important way. Another way is to go to the internet and read our magazine, H Plus Magazine. It's fresh articles every day, and they touch all bases. They're very transdisciplinary. Another way is to go to the conferences. We usually have three a year. Our conferences have been held at Parsons in New York City, Caltech, Harvard, Yale University, and we have an upcoming conference in China that Ben Gritzwell is chairing. So that's going to be an exciting event. Another way is to Facebook. Certainly Facebook. You can join the group on Facebook. You can attend some of our virtual events. We have an upcoming leadership event in Second Life at Terrison Foundation's Island, which will be very exciting and I hope well attended. So these are just some of the ways. But basically, transhumanism is a way of looking at the world from not just a philosophical perspective, but a perspective that's very practical. It's not just a philosophy. It's a way of dealing with the world in a practical basis through innovation, ingenuity, design, and researching and understanding how we are affected by and how we are affecting the emerging and speculative technologies and who we will become. It's an exciting time for us because we're able to sit down at the drawing board and sketch out what type of people we want to be and how we want to address our own growth and development and our own species in sustaining our species and continuing our lifespan.
So in a sense, sort of putting ourselves in the driver's seat around our own evolution, if you will.
Yes, I think that's a very articulate way of looking at it.
Well, Natasha, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us, and we look forward to hearing about more great stuff from Humanity Plus in the near future.
Thank you. Always enjoy being on your show, Phil, and good luck to you, and I look forward to listening to this.
All right, thanks. So once again, if you're interested in finding out more information, go to hplusmagazine.com or go to humanityplus.org or follow the links that we've got to Humanity Plus at worldtransformed.com. Finally, I'd like to thank each of you for being with us this evening, with a special shout out to Sally and all our friends in the chat room. Thanks for being with us. Also, thanks to all our friends from the Singularity Network who've joined us this evening, and to Singularity Network founder Jean-Sébastien Bimius for providing the excellent theme music that we've used throughout this series. Well, next week, The World Transformed 2 concludes with Part 10, Human Destiny Transformed. Please join us as we welcome Robin Hansen, John Smart, Vanessa Miamis, and Kevin Kelly. I hope you'll be able to join us. And until next time, live to see it.